Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Mosh and Sarah talk about songs.
Yes, we certainly do talk about songs. And we also, in the current season, talk about 90s films. Welcome back to episode 3 of our mini-season in which we are ranking 90s soundtracks. I am your co-host, Mark Blankenship, and with me as ever, the Jenny to my forest, the Bubba to my forest, the Lieutenant Dan to my forest, it's Sarah D. Bunting.
I think I might actually be the forest here. Who can say, hello, it's me, Sarah D. Bunting.
Perhaps you've already guessed by my incredibly witty opening remarks that we will today be ranking the soundtrack to Forrest Gump, a film that if you were sentient in 1994, you heard about so much that you wanted to throw yourself into traffic. I'm sorry, I don't mean to editorialize, but good Lord. In a year when both The Lion King and Forrest Gump came out, I cannot remember a time when there were two such dominant pop culture forces, perhaps until Barbenheimer. Anyway, we are, however, not ranking everything on the Forrest Gump soundtrack because that soundtrack was a double disc behemoth that contained 31 hits of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and also something called the Forrest Gump Suite, which, good Lord. So in order to cull that down to a manageable size, we asked the Patreon patrons to vote for their top songs in the entire collection. And then Sarah and I made some choices as well. And then, based on the patron votes and Sarah's and my preferences, we narrowed this down to the 16 songs from the Forrest Gump soundtrack that we most wanted to talk about. And Sarah, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn when I say that part of the rationale behind our choices was we just have nothing left to say about some of the songs and artists on this soundtrack. Respect by Aretha Franklin. I have nothing left. There was Mrs. Robinson by Simon and Garfunkel. Like, no, we have nothing left to say. So we also took the opportunity to choose some of the songs from this soundtrack that give us some interesting new pathways to cover, and as well as choosing some of the most obvious picks. Sarah, does that feel accurate to you?
Yeah. I mean, if you voted on this, first of all, thank you. And second of all, you will understand if we are estranged from Mrs. Robinson in terms of, you know, like, is it a classic? Yes. Is that the sum total of what I have left to say about it? Yes.
If you would like to hear us go on at length about that song, dig back into the archives and find, oh God, I'm sure it's in there somewhere.
Oh yeah.
It's in the Grammy season. Yeah, it's in there.
It's in the Grammy season. It's in, I think we mention it in passing, but like the Bridge Over Troubled Water two-part.
Weeping season.
Episode, yes, like the season of weeping. I just, you know, if you've been here before, you understand why we're not addressing it. If you are new here, welcome. We're glad that you're here. And this is a good time to review how we do mathematically a ranking episode on Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. And it goes like this. We're going in alphabetical order by song. We'll give you a list in a sec. But my number one song is going to get 16 points. My number two song is going to get 15 points, all the way down to my 16th favorite or least favorite song, which will get 1 point. I made this list and did this arithmetic. Mark made this list and did this arithmetic, and our Patreon supporters also contributed. Mark is the keeper of the math in this pod marriage, so I'm not sure how he chose to do this, given that we didn't use every song that the Patreons ranked. I guess we'll find out. It's a journey we go on together. But anyway, once we put all those points together, then we have the definitive ranking of these 16 songs.
Well, I'll just explain myself here in front of God, dog, and everybody.
Yeah.
After we had chosen the 16 songs that made the cut, I then sent a new poll out to Patreon that included only these 16 songs, working from the assumption that the remaining songs were numbers 17 through 32. Mm-hmm. So we are now ranking our top 16. So as we said in Slack, Sarah, this episode may not quite carry the force of Law in its final mm-hmm. rankings as the others do, but still, at least at the county level, it will still have legal authority.
Okay.
Well, to get started, and I think as we're talking about the songs, we can talk about let me back up. Sarah, as we start, let me ask you this. Did you rewatch some or all of Forrest Gump before we sat down to do this?
I did rewatch some of it just to sort of gut check myself about my memories and impressions. Like, I don't think I had interacted with it as a film in a couple decades.
Yeah.
Because I didn't need to. Like, it was so extensively parodied, but that's why I wanted to kind of go back and have a look at it just to be like, well, what was this actually? What about you? I think you said you watched the whole movie, right?
I did rewatch the whole movie, which is available on some streaming service. I can never keep it straight. But I hadn't seen this movie definitely since 1995 or 1996 when it was on a 2 VHS cassette tape release.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, kids, ask your great-grandparents. There used to be a time when long movies would be sold on VHS, but they would be so long that they would fill up an entire cassette. So you would have to stop in the middle of the movie and change the tape over.
Mm-hmm.
You have no idea what it was like. Yeah. People, it was hard.
And at my parents' house, we were still rocking the fucking top loader.
Yes.
Get up. Oh, yeah.
And we had one that had wood panel on the side, top loading VCR, like wood paneled. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And
pioneers.
The things. Exactly. Ms. Cather, she spoke of us.
She did.
You think Ma Jode had it rough? F you! Grapes of what? I don't know. Anyway, I have a lot to say about this film that we can talk about as we dig into it, but I will just start by saying that for all of the things about this movie that have aged like, oh, let's say warm milk in the sun,
The trunk chicken salad.
Yeah, exactly.
The patron salad of Mastess.
I was furious, Sarah, to find myself crying at the end of this movie. I was actually upset. I was like laughing at myself. I was crying. He's talking to Jenny's ghost and like adorable little Haley Joel Osment is running around with his bangs in his eyes. And I was like, I hate you for making me cry. So... Yeah. This
awful.
Movie is just as saccharine and manipulative as you remember, but also surprisingly effective.
I didn't watch much. I watched like 20 minutes, half an hour. And I remembered it as being like the jukebox musical of prestige movies somehow.
Yeah.
And I would say that impression was more or less correct.
Yes.
In the sense that I think jukebox musicals are, I mean, is it great epic storytelling like it wants to think it is? Not necessarily. But is it effective at what it's trying to do in the way that it tries to do it? Yes.
Exactly right. And, oh, man. Okay, so enough of that. We'll get into more of the film later. Let's begin with our songs. Now, we don't have clips for the first three choices on the soundtrack, but we still have things to say. First up, alphabetically, actually, let me back up. Sarah, before we begin, should I just read quickly through a list of all the songs we'll be talking about today?
Yeah, why not?
Okay, today we'll be discussing Against the Wind by Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band, California Dreamin' by the Mamas and the Papas, Everybody's Talkin' by Harry Nilsson, Fortunate Son by Creedence Clearwater Revival, For What It's Worth by Buffalo Springfield, I've Got to Use My Imagination by Gladys Knight and the Pips, Joy to the World by Three Dog Night, Land of a Thousand Dances by Wilson Pickett, On the Road Again by Willie Nelson, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head by BJ Thomas, Rainy Day Women number 12 and 35, Bob Dylan, Rebel Rouser by Duane Eddy, San Francisco by Scott McKenzie, Sloop John B by the Beach Boys, Stoned Love by the Supremes, and Turn, Turn, Turn by the Byrds.
Oh boy. All right. We've got a long road ahead of us, and I think we might be against the wind.
Yes! I'll just start here, Sarah. I have a lot of memories of the song Old Time Rock and Roll by Bob Seger. Mm-hmm. I can remember being a little boy in my house and just going, spending what felt like hours choreographing a number to Bob Seger's Old Time Rock and Roll. And I was imagining there was like a whole group of people and we were in various costumes and we were shaking our fingers at people who didn't like rock and roll. I really, really got into that. And I also have a lot of memories of Shakedown, which was Bob Seger's number one hit from the Beverly Hills Cop 2 soundtrack.
Sure.
What I don't have a lot of memories of are Against the Wind, a number five hit from 1980. And for me, Sarah, this is a song that no matter how many times I listen to it, I cannot seem to retain it. It's in that Teflon black hole place for me. How about you?
I always forget how much I like Bob Seger until I'm like obliged to listen to it again. But like you, or sort of parallel to you, if I'm not obliged to listen to Bob Seger, his existence is like airlocked. It's the kind of the same thing that it's like, right. This is perfectly cromulent. And I just forget that it exists immediately after interacting with it. Like, I enjoyed listening to Against the Wind. I think it's a, like Bob Seger, kind of, they're all the same song a little bit.
yes.
And the lyric, I wish I didn't know now what I didn't know then, is good. Like, I think that he's really a good, not craftsman, but like constructor of like, you know, like slightly twangy road dog pop songs that turn the 80s style. With that said, I don't need it. I didn't need to clip it. This was too long. He was basically done at 4 minutes 22, but we were around for another minute, which is also a Seger issue. So I had this at number 12.
Mm-hmm.
Got nothing against it, but someone had to be 12th, 5 points.
And this is the type of song that you need because you have to play something at the Little League game when it's time for people to quickly go to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that as an insult. The culture needs songs like this, but I agree with you.
Well, I also had in my notes, sometimes the DJ has to pee.
Yeah, exactly.
So you got a 5 minute plusser. Yep, sure.
And at the end of the day, Like a Rock or Old Time Rock and Roll, those are the same song, but they're just more culturally prominent. So I'll choose those. So I put the song in 14th place and gave it 3 points, which is more just for the same reasons you just described. But the patrons really were into it and they put it in 8th place, which gives it 9 points from them. So, okay. Now, next we have a song that I have been singing probably since I was in the womb, to one degree or another, and that is California Dreamin' by the Mamas and the Papas, a song that I've always thought, surprisingly, did not actually go to number one when it was released as a single. It peaked at number four, but remains to my mind. Yeah, their only number one hit is Monday, Monday.
Oh.
But this song, I feel
you
like...
You can't trust that day.
Yeah, no, you can't. Mm. But this was the Mamas and the Papas' debut single. It peaked at number four in 1966. And I think it is one of the songs that people point to the most when they talk about good music from the 60s. And there's a reason for that. It's a great song about yearning to be somewhere that you're not. It's a great song about meeting people like priests who like the conditions that you're both sharing, even though you don't. And the harmonies are beautiful and there's a haunting quality to it. And listen, I'm not over here trying to say that I'm some idiosyncratic breaker of rules or whatever. I think this song is great. I didn't clip it because I don't need to.
Right.
But I have a lot of memories attached to this song that are good. It's also part of a lot of films. I really like it. So I put it in fourth place, 13 points. And I'll get here into explaining how I ended up making some of my higher ranking choices for this particular episode. If a song evokes some particular image of Forrest Gump to me, or an impression of Forrest Gump, then that also bumped it up the rankings. And California Dreamin' to me epitomizes how badly this movie treats Jenny, who gets punished over and over and over again for embracing anything that could even be lightly considered counterculture. I mean, this poor mm-hmm. character, she almost kills herself multiple times. She ultimately dies of an unnamed virus that is so obviously AIDS, or HIV, I should say. She so obviously dies of AIDS. Everything that she does that's supposed to embody the attempt to live free ultimately brings a horrible consequence, while Forrest mm-hmm. Gump continues to uphold certain conservative values and he gets everything that he wants. But that being said, California Dreamin' is connected in my mind to Jenny, so it's also a Forrest Gump song. That's one of the reasons I put it in fourth place, 13 points.
I was sort of trying to rank things like outside of the experience of the film, but also in how well they, like, all of these songs are overplayed. Is that a consequence of their being on this soundtrack, or is that why, is it cause or effect?
Right.
Is it the chicken or the egg, right? California Dreamin', like, none of these songs, with a couple of exceptions, are going to escape like accusations of overuse. But the song's ability to kind of resist that, like a lot of songs are overplayed, but I don't get sick of them. So that was kind of the rubric for me. I had California Dreamin', to my surprise, at third place with 14 points because I don't think I just sat and listened to it. I love the Mamas and the Papas. My parents had all their LPs. I listened to them as a kid. This sort of dark hymnic sound in this song, and the vocal goes way harder than it has to, especially in the back half, which I think people kind of like stop actively listening after those opening bars, which is true of a lot of the songs that we're going to talk about. But there is this like Joan Didion adjacent, the dark sort of underbelly of Southern California, and like that, you know, the narrator wants to go towards this like sunny utopia, but sort of realizes on some level that this is just like self-soothing, and wherever he goes, there he is.
Right.
I could be reading too much into it. People are doing a lot of drugs. It's a beautiful song that has a like a little shadow crossing the sun of it that really gives you a little chill. And I think it's extremely successful. So third place.
I think you are absolutely right about the darkness that's implicit in the song, because the key in which the song is performed is lower and slightly more ominous than it necessarily needed to be. You could hear, if this song were being sung higher up in a higher octave, it wouldn't sound nearly as menacing. And that's intentional. And also, Mama Cass's voice is so rich and low, and it just invites a sort of like emotional languor that is really, or implies an emotional languor that I find really seductive. And I guess many people do, obviously. So agreed. So the patrons also really, really agree with us. They put this song, in fact, in first place, and therefore it gets 16 points. So number 4, 3, and 1, a solid, solid performance from California Dreamin'. Now, I will say, Sarah, the question of overplay is interesting when you get to a song like Everybody's Talkin' by Nilsson or Harry Nilsson. How familiar were you with this song?
Quite.
Oh, okay.
Because it, I think, existed. I mean, I still associate it with Midnight Cowboy and with like every single parody of Midnight Cowboy in that last scene on the bus. And, you know, that's always playing like in a Simpsons episode and whatever SNL parodies of it. Like, but the song manages to resist. First of all, I don't associate this song with Forrest Gump at all. I associate it with Midnight Cowboy and fucking John Voight wandering the grimy streets of Manhattan in the late 60s and Sylvia Miles and everything else. And there is a that association, which is also, like the last song we talked about, kind of twinning this like sunny sound with dark content,
right?
I think is also very successful. I don't know, like, I really don't know how good the song is separated from all of those associations, because I can't separate them, but I think it's a good performance, and it, like, tells its story and gets out, which, thank you, 60s. So, sixth place for me, 11 points.
I think it's interesting how many of the songs on the Forrest Gump soundtrack, including many more that we're going to talk about today, are associated with the soundtracks of other films.
Agreed.
Which gets at something about Forrest Gump itself being a cheat sheet to feeling and meaning. It mm-hmm. doesn't earn its association so much as it signals at existing associations and then hopes it can coast off of that tailwind.
Oh, yeah. It's like a laminated card.
And it's in the same way that the movie is constantly saying that Forrest Gump invented things like the have a nice day smiley face shirt or the shit happens bumper sticker or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Just but we're not Mark and Sarah do film criticism. So to me, Everybody's Talking is a song that I really didn't know. I saw Midnight Cowboy once, like 15 years ago. I mostly think of Nilsson as the song being connected to the song Without You. This to me was just, I just have never really thought about this song. When I listened to it, if I had listened to it without knowing what it was, I wouldn't have been able to tell you what it was, if you know what I mean.
Right. Yeah, I do.
And for me, I kept waiting for the song to become something else, to evolve sonically. But to me, musically, it was a really beautiful, striking opening minute. And then it just was that only. And I wish that the song had been more dynamic. And I can see how in a film, you don't need that because it's underneath John Voight in his brown leather jacket with the fringes on the arms.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I do know the iconic images of Midnight Cowboy, even though I don't remember. I've only seen the film once. Anyway. So to me, it was just kind of a non-entity, even though I should also note that because of its presence in Midnight Cowboy, it did reach number 6 on the Hot 100 in 1969. Mm-hmm. So I put it in 13th place and only gave it 4 points.
Okay. I think I probably ranked it too high. What did the patrons do with it?
They were in between us. They put it in 9th place and gave it 8 points.
Well, that's probably closer to the truth.
But now we have a song that we have, in fact, clipped. This is Creedence Clearwater Revival's number 2 hit single, Fortunate Son. And before we go further, let's go ahead and listen to some music. Some folks are born, silver spoon in hand. Y'all don't they help themselves, y'all. But when the tax man comes to the door, y'all the house looking like a rum and sand.
Here's one that I think I probably put too low. I really love Creedence, actually, because I'm a basic. But this song is one that, like, for me, has suffered from overplay because I think part of the overplay is that I feel like I hear it in the background in news footage of like conservative politicians' rallies that I'm like, I don't think John Fogerty wants anything to do with that. But I also don't think this is a particularly good vocal. I don't think this is as good or subtle of storytelling as Creedence is capable of. This is like bottom half. Creedence for me. But it's like, I do think that the vocal kind of reflects the content. I think it's a good song, but I don't know. I kind of can't with it anymore. Like, the immediate association is like, oh, this is B-roll of dudes jumping out of Hueys in Vietnam. And that's what it's supposed to be, but I'm exhausted. 11th place, 6 points.
Whoa. Okay. Let me, before I take another step forward, let me acknowledge it actually peaked at number 3, not at number 2. It was a double A-side single with Down on the Corner, another excellent Creedence Clearwater Revival song.
Yeah, very good.
Well, you and I are walking on different roads here because, to me, Fortunate Son is one of my favorite songs of the entire 60s. I love it so much. Huh. I think that John Fogerty's vocal is great in this song. To me, it's like the fucking bomb. I feel like there is so much obvious passion and anger in this song. It feels like the howl of someone who is tired of living in an unjust society. And that's what the song quite literally is. The section that I clipped is the verse where he talks about people who have a lot of money making their house look like a rummage sale when it's time for the tax collector to come poke their head in. And obviously that is something that remains as true today as ever and was true before the song as well. And the intensity, the urgency of the music, the arrangement, the whole orchestration of the song is very exciting to me. I also do absolutely associate this song with Forrest Gump because it was the first time that I really noticed the song was because of this movie. I'm sure I had heard it before, but John Fogerty to me growing up was more the guy who sang Center Field because my dad loved that album. And so we listened to that album so much. And of course I knew Proud Mary, Bad Moon Rising, but this one became a song that I knew because of this film. But to me, again, I just cannot get enough of this. It feels as fresh and raw and urgent and necessary to me now as it did in the 90s. I guess I just don't really watch a whole lot of cable news or whatever you're watching, so I don't really ever hear it.
I feel like this either is on the soundtrack because it was always on war footage, or it was always on war footage because it was on the soundtrack. Either way, like, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I think it's a good, effective song, but if I never hear it again, that will be fine.
That's so interesting.
Does not rise above for me. I could listen to Lodi 17 times in a row and not get sick of it. This, I fucking can't.
Well, for me, this is my number one.
Wow.
Yes.
That is very cool.
All the way in first place.
Love that.
16 points. And the patrons put it in second place with 15 points. So,
but all right. So I didn't really have to rank it anywhere except where I did.
This is why I like doing these episodes, and I'm glad that we don't talk about them in advance.
No,
because truly, like, perfectly valid responses on both sides. But to me, I will be listening to this song enough for the both of us. So don't you worry if you never need to actively choose to listen to it again.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Even if that weren't true. Still not listening to it again.
Amazing.
Sorry, like, John.
You mean if I never choose to listen to this song again, it will vanish? Well, sorry. Okay.
Yep. Bye.
next we have what is probably the greatest example of all time of a song not being named what you think it's named. That is Buffalo Springfield's For What It's Worth. And that is, of course, the song Stop, Hey, What's That Sound? But it's not called that. It's called For What It's Worth. Words that never actually appear in the song itself. It's Buffalo Springfield's only hit, but it is one of those hits that is just going to be with us forever. It peaked at number 7 in 1967. And of course, Buffalo Springfield was an all-star band featuring Stephen Stills, Neil Young, many, many other people. And then half of them went on to be in Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, whatever. So like an important part of that whole great timeline of rock from this era when everybody was in a band for like one album and then they were in everybody else's band.
And then they renamed themselves. And yes. Like, this is half the Byrds and half CSNY. Yeah, yeah.
It's like, and I think we're all in Traffic, but I can't remember. And so Sarah, for me, and before we go on, let's listen to a clip.
Down over there. Telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
So I may be the only one who feels this way, but I have to this song the response that you have to Fortunate Son, which is, I feel like it is the most generic, obvious choice when you want to evoke people who go to Woodstock and don't want to go fight in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I don't think the song is good. I don't like it. I think it's boring. I think it is poorly sung. It has no emotion or verve. It feels like something that's sleepy because no one could be arsed to make something better. I have never liked it. I do not like it today. I think it is a cheap signifier. And though it isn't offensive, its tapioca quality to me is offensive in a way. I would be content if this song vanished forever. It won't, and I know I'll be forced to listen to it multiple more times, I'm so upset that I can't even speak with proper grammar. I know I'm going to be forced to listen to it many more times in my life. I won't like it at any point. It's probably playing in a bank vestibule at this very moment. For me, it is in 15th place, 2 points.
Okay. This is absolutely ruthlessly overused and should be put on ice for a period of 5 to 10 years. Like, if you're looking at a slow-mo scene in your late '60s movie where the cops are throwing smoke grenades and you are tempted to be like, don't. Just have someone hum it instead. With that said, despite the absolutely ruthless shortcut use of it by shows that include Beverly Hills goddamn 90210, like, get the fuck out of here, seriously, I feel that this is really well built. They use it for a reason. It has a solid terrain, like it builds its terrain. There are some phrasings that are needlessly tortured. Into your life it will creep is still a no, all, like, you know, half a century later. And I think that it is, has been overused for a reason. Like, I think that it sort of has that, it has space in the beginning of it that lets a scene build over it. I don't think anything you said is incorrect, but I, you know, despite being tired of its shortcutty use, I think it has earned that status as like the gold standard of, oh, 60s flashback. So I put in fifth place, 12 points.
Hey! And the patrons were much more aligned with you. They put it in seventh place with 10 points.
Yeah, that's about right.
So, all right. Well, I wasn't quite as opposite to everyone else, in my opinion, but I was still opposite. But you know what? That's all right. It's a free country, damn it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, next we have the act that created many years ago at this point the glorious idea of Pip Shade here on Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. And that is, I barely even remember what that means, Sarah, but I still know it's a thing we did.
Yeah, I think it's the Pips coming in Midnight Train to Georgia and being like, girl.
That's what it was. They're like, yeah, okay, you can make that choice if you want, but you're stupid. Well, Sarah. Yeah.
But she's like, well, I still love him, blah, blah, blah. And the Pips are like, we'll talk later.
So as it happens, I've Got to Use My Imagination, which is the song we're talking about now, was the follow-up single to Midnight Train to Georgia. And it peaked at number 4 in 1974. And Sarah, I wonder what your thoughts are on this particular stomper by Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Bored. I was bored. I don't think there's anything to this song. I'm sure it tore it up at the clubs. I hope they made money from it. But I had no memory of this at all. Never mind from the movie. It sounds like it was composed for soundtrack purposes, even though I know it wasn't, which is not good. 14th place, 3 points. I wanted to love it. I don't care. I couldn't even sing it to you right now. We should have pulled a clip. I've already forgotten what it sounds like.
You and the patrons agreed. They also put it in 14th place with 3 points. Now, I associate the song with Latrice Royale winning a lip sync on the fourth season of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Okay, that's a solid association.
I got to keep on keeping on. And I can see Latrice doing the sort of railroad arm movements, chugga 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 movements.
Mm-hmm.
I love Gladys Knight's voice in any context because I think she is one of the greatest singers in all of pop music. And she is able to evoke so much feeling, thinking, emotion, storytelling, whatever. So I have a real soft spot for this song because of the two things I just mentioned. And though I could not move it into my top five, I did put it at number 7 because I'm always going to be happy to hear a sassy up-tempo song. And what I will say about I've Got to Use My Imagination that I like the most is the last 45-ish seconds when the instrumentation freaks out and she just starts ad-libbing wails over the top. And I just want a moment in every Gladys Knight song where she does that. It's like the I've Got to Go part of Midnight Train to Georgia. It's the at the end of If I Were Your Woman when she's like just hollering. I just wait for that moment in every song and she gives it to me here. However, I clearly am hearing things that many folks do not hear because, like I said, you and the patrons are completely aligned and I will humbly accept this difference of opinion.
I mean, yeah, I just, there's something about it that's like, it either needed to be way less dance floor or way more openly disco. There's something about Gladys Knight's performance quality that did not fit this, like, speed.
Fair.
I think.
Listen, fair enough. So I give it 10 points. You and the patrons collectively give it 6 points. Sorry, Gladys, but you know what? Midnight Train to Georgia remains a song that unites us all.
Indeed.
Now, speaking of songs that we really don't need to clip, I mean, I keep saying that. Maybe there are people who don't know Three Dog Night's Joy to the World.
Yeah.
But Sarah, I sure as hell do. How about you?
I certainly do. And no one who is named Jeremiah,
bless their hearts,
wants any part of this shit. I had not listened to this entire song for 20 years, probably, because I had forgotten that, like, the opening is actually annoying still and not well sung. But I have to say, like, credit for being, like, if we ever get around to doing the great opening 8 bars season, like, this entire soundtrack will be on it again. But, like, I would never seek this song out at this point, but it, like, it won me over by the time it got to the key change. That it was like, oh, right, this is fun. This is a fun song that everybody knows. This is a song that, like, little kids sing along with in carpool. Like, this is a crowd pleaser. This is an all ages dance.
Yes.
This is a fun song. Do I need to hear it again? No. Was I impressed with its ability to be like, I don't know, come on. Just, I don't know, a little wiggle. Just give us till the key change. We'll convince you. And it did. Fourth place, 13 points.
You know what? Just give us a minute. We're going to get them asses shaking. We're going to get them hips swiveling.
But he's just like, Jeremiah, what? I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. Like, arms fully folded, like, eh-eh. And then 45 seconds later, bugging out.
And you're like, you know what? If I were the king of the world, I would also make sweet love to you. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, let me tell you what I do. I dance to this song. Why the fuck not?
My mom loves the band Three Dog Night, so I was very familiar with their music when I was growing up. And I was shocked later to learn that Easy to Be Hard was from Hair. When I was a child, it never occurred to me that Easy to Be Hard was not a Three Dog Night song. But anyway, I really love this song. Will always love this song. It was number one for 6 weeks. It's their biggest hit. It's from 1971. Mm-hmm. And I kept bouncing this around in my top six. Like, it just kept moving because I kept talking myself into like, but how associated is it with you, with Forrest Gump? Blah, blah, blah. So I ultimately landed at sixth place with 11 points. But I could have been exactly with you in fourth place. Like, I was just sort of in that general zone. And the patrons also put it in sixth place. So that is a good showing for the gentlemen of Three Dog Night.
Mm-hmm. All three dogs.
Yes, exactly. So we do have a clip for our next song, and that's Wilson Pickett's Land of a Thousand Dances, another song where the title tells you nothing about the song, and you might think you don't know it until you hear it. But anyway,
you absolutely do, and we can prove it to you. Shall I play a clip?
Yes, please.
I think this might be my favorite Wilson Pickett song. He does have a certain quality. You know those songs, I think the first song that we ever talked about where we did this, it's like the first 30 seconds is all you need songs.
Yes.
And we were talking about It's Your Thing.
Yes.
And that, like, those iconic opening bars, and then it's like, well, and now you're done. Like, you already shot your wad, and we don't need to be here for another 2 minutes. Most of Wilson Pickett's songs are like that. This song is not like that, in my opinion. I think that there is like judicious use of the horns and of the sax and of the like dropping out of sound. It's just like unbridled joy at his own skill at this. I mean, it is overplayed, but that's Wilson Pickett for you. Like, that's what you want as a pop artist, is to be overplayed, in my opinion. I couldn't put it higher than seventh, but I'm okay with seventh for this one. 10 points.
I appreciate so much that you mentioned the length of the song, because one of the reasons I love this song is that it is 2 minutes and 26 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
It's basically just, here are some dances that we're going to do. Here is some wordless chanting that I'm going to sing while you do those dances. And here's a hype-ass instrumental track with some hype-ass horns to make sure that your ass is wiggling so that we can do those dances. And I'm going to tell you, Sarah, this one really took me by surprise, because I found myself coming back to it over and over again. It just was such a joy bomb. And I found this happened to me in our First Name Basis season when we talked about Mustang Sally. So maybe I'm like a secret Wilson Pickett fan and I haven't been giving him enough credit, because I also would happily listen to In the Midnight Hour at literally any time. So, Sarah, I'm going to tell you what. I shook my little tush all the way to second place with Land of a Thousand Dances.
That's legit.
I think it was just...
I respect a pop song that can be like, the object of this is to get your panties on the ground.
Yes.
And if I cannot accomplish this in 2 minutes 26, I don't deserve the panties.
That's right. You know
I'm
what?
I'm going to do what I do. You're going to wear what you're wearing. And we're going to fucking see.
And like,
respect for that.
If you're not so sweaty by the end of this that your bra has landed on the chandelier, then I don't know what else to do. And I will humbly leave. Exactly right.
Yes, exactly.
Now, the reason
I accept the decision of the underpants court.
Which is not to be confused with the high court, which is about a song that makes you feel like you want to do drugs. Now, this song, I swear to God, I started it in like ninth. And by the end of the process, I had scratched out so many numbers. It's like a like cannon fodder, like field of battle on my notebook, where I was just like blah, blah. And finally there it was at number two, because it was the one song I kept coming back to over and over again. And there we go. Now, the patrons loved it less than either one of us. They put it in 11th place with 6 points. But you know what, I have to believe, this is what I choose to believe, I think that some people were voting without listening, and they looked at that song title and they didn't think that they knew what the song was.
Yeah.
That's what I think happened.
That's okay. We can't control what happens in the
No.
At the ballot box. We can't.
Well, I'm going to tell you something else that I wasn't expecting to happen. This entire episode was filled with me going, oh, I guess I love this. I didn't know how much I loved On the Road Again by Willie Nelson, which I wasn't prepared. I just was listening to it and I was like, God, I'm really feeling affected by the pathos of someone who is happily saying that they live their life on the road, but then also it's clear that they yearn for stability. And this is somehow the core of every mm-hmm. single country song. Like, country music itself is fundamentally about the tension between wanting to be home and wanting to leave. And Willie Nelson's yeah. voice is the perfect conduit for this emotion. And oh my God, why is it so beautiful? And it's so restrained, but so powerful. And third place.
Wow.
Third place, 14 points. A song that I have heard.
Sort of. Sorry, go ahead.
No, a song that I have heard a gazillion times because I think it was in like a Motel 6 ad. Like, it, this song has just been blasted to death. And in an
yeah,
era,
I feel like multiple car commercials
yes.
with this one as well.
And in an era when you could not avoid commercials as easily as you can avoid commercials today, meaning we were subjected to it. But I had enough distance from On the Road Again, third place, 14 points.
A lot of my meta journey in this ranking process was giving myself permission to not give a shit about certain songs. And this one, I really felt I revere Willie Nelson. He is an icon. He is on the, you know, Rushmore of the American songbook. All fine. This song does not quite work for me the way I want it to. I feel like the tempo is not correct. I feel like it needs to be slowed down a little bit. I do like the song, but I feel like I have seen it in enough Chevrolet commercials. I could be remembering that wrong, but I had to. And it's not like at the bottom. It's in ninth place, 8 points. But there was a process of like acceptance of self and forgiveness of self that I was like, oh, like, sorry, buddy. Like, I have posed with that statue of him in Austin multiple times. I love him. No disrespect, but like putting this in ninth, I was just like, look, someone has to be ninth. He will forgive you. He can handle it.
I'm just not
sure how it's going to go for BJ Thomas, who
the existentialism of that is great for me. Now, I do have to include some fun facts here. Willie Nelson was nominated for an Oscar for this song because it was from a movie called, wait for it, Honeysuckle Rose. You know,
sure.
Honeysuckle Rose, a film that exists, I'm certain.
Yep.
And it was at the time his biggest pop hit, although that was eventually superseded on the charts by, of all things, To All the Girls I've Loved Before.
Oh, God.
With Julio Iglesias. But thank God we don't have to talk about that song.
Brutal.
You put the song in ninth. I put the song in third. The patrons put it in fifth. So there we go. Now,
good job.
I think that I ranked Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head too high, and I didn't even rank it high. That's how I'm just going to kick it off by saying that, Sarah.
I think I ranked it too high, and I ranked it in fucking last. I did not realize. I mean, I could sing every word of this song, which I associate with Butch and Sundance.
Of course, because
not
that's
with Forrest Gump.
Because it's from that soundtrack once again, and it was an Oscar winner for that soundtrack.
But this is like such a square, I mean, it's such a square vocal and such square instrumentation. But I will also say that like Butch and Sundance is one of those, like, my parents loved that movie and I thought it was just like annoying.
Yes.
Like, it was a pest, this movie. And the scene that this scores is like, I just want to slap everyone involved and then myself for watching the whole thing. And so that association is not BJ Thomas's fault, but this is, I feel the worst of a certain late 60s, early 70s hyper focus on one symbol, like Gilbert O'Sullivan had a lot of tracks that are like this, and it's just like rain. But, I mean, in short, fuck off. 1 point.
So
it's totally irrational, but I just wanted to kick something after listening to the song again.
I have tried in the last 5 years on 3 separate occasions to watch the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I can never get further than 30 minutes in.
No.
And then I legitimately, I think because I'm psychically protecting myself, I forget to finish watching it. And then 2 years later, I think, oh yeah, I never finished that. And after the third time, I finally accepted, I'm just never going to watch this fucking movie because it is so twee. That's the thing about it. That, I mean, the what
I'm picturing. Here I am, my petticoats on the handlebar. Eat a bee.
You are just the very soul of my thoughts, because I was just about to say, when I think about this movie, I think about Catherine Ross on the handlebars of a bike, and I'm like, you're not cute. What the hell are we doing here? And then this
go marry Sam Elliott and get out of my face. Actually, don't do that. Fuck you for that also.
This song was written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David, and they have written a lot of good songs, but they also have a definite type of song that they write. And it's a little cutesy poo, bouncy melody, bossa nova style lyrics that are charming, but meaningless. And without the texture of a Dionne Warwick to add a little bit of drama to the song, and you instead get the capable crooning of BJ Thomas, all you're left with is burp, 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 burp. It just feels like a fucking song that a Muppet is singing at me.
Yeah.
And I don't mean one of the funny Muppets. I mean one of the stupid Muppets. And I don't know which one of those. I don't even. Wow. I am so mad at myself that I allowed this song to somehow make it into 12th. Like, what the hell was I thinking, Sarah?
Do we have to fire the patrons? What did they do with it?
No, they also put it in 12th. So I guess if they go, okay. I go. But clearly, this song, inexplicably to me, was number one for 4 damn weeks as well in the late 60s, early 70s. It won an Oscar. Like, what the hell? So, Now, however, do not think I should have put this song in last place, Sarah, because the song that I put in last place, to me, absolutely fucking deserves to be there. Rainy Day Women, numbers 12 and 35, is a song that can eat 7 pounds of wasps. I hate it so much. I was almost going to clip this song, as you might recall. And then I was like, why would I make myself...
I was so relieved that you didn't.
I was going to clip it because I felt like it was so bad that I needed to just like... But then I thought, I've punished myself enough. I've punished you enough. Bob Dylan is a Nobel Prize winner, and in the way that you were talking about with the just giving yourself permission not to give a shit, I in large part don't give a shit about the music of Bob Dylan, if I'm being frank with you. Like, I understand and of course appreciate that he has written some absolute masterpieces. I have no, of course he has. Blowin' in the Wind, another song that was on this soundtrack, is a great song. I mean, Bob Dylan has written at least 24 songs whose songwriting I enjoy. I'm not a fool. But like, I am so resistant to this idea that I am supposed to prostrate myself at the feet of someone who writes a song where a bunch of assholes are screaming about everybody getting stoned or whatever. Just shut up is how I feel about this song. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. Even though inexplicably it reached number 2 on the Hot 100, I put it in last place, and that is 1 point, and I wish I could give it less than that.
Only because Raindrops Are Falling on My Head was already in the basement did this avoid the basement. I do like early in the song when he chuckles during that, because that's like such an un-Dylan moment.
Yes.
But I hung out with big Dylan fan stoners in college. I have heard certain Dylan songs that I'm supposed to think are masterpieces enough. I've heard them more times than actual Bob Dylan has heard them. And this one, I'm fucking done. Ha ha, everybody must get stoned. What are you, 19? No.
Yeah.
15th place, 2 points. I just... Dylan is like Taylor Swift in that you're not allowed to have a sort of non-primary color opinion.
Right.
It's reverence or loathing. In between, there's no vehicles allowed in that lane. And I just can't. That's not how I feel. I think he did some amazing stuff. I think he did some stuff that was garbage, but I like it. And I don't want to write a master's thesis about it or talk about it in that way. But that's not allowed by the culture. That's annoying. So is the song. What do the Patreons do?
They put it in 13th place and gave it 4 points. So that's we correct. All are on a... Now, I will say you've hit on what my frustration is with Bob Dylan. It's, as we've talked about so much, it's also the same with the Beatles. It's less the artist and more the way that people talk about the artist. Mm-hmm. And you're so right that the Taylor Swift thing is exactly the same. And yeah, Bob Dylan has some great songs. Bob Dylan has some shitty songs. And like you just said, there's nothing about what Bob Dylan does as an artist that makes me want to dig into it. And you know what? I don't have to, because God knows there are always going to be other people willing to do that. And I just, he's not someone who really gets me interested. He's fine. And some of the songs are great and fine. Fine. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this song is not great. Blah, blah, blah.
Want to teach your kids financial literacy but not sure where to start? Greenlight can help. With Greenlight, parents can keep an eye on kids' spending and saving, while kids and teens use a card of their own to build money confidence. As a parent, you can send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and more. It's a convenient way to run your household, customized to your family's needs, and the easy way to raise financially smart kids. Get started with Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/pod.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
How, now we can finally cleanse our palates and listen to a clip. So before we talk about Duane Eddy's number 6 hit from 1958, Rebel Rouser, let's listen to a snatch. What do you say?
This is my number 2 song, 15 points. I don't think I have to explain myself, but I'm going to. The build of this, that bell tone guitar, that it just keeps adding things in, and that it is rightly clearly impressed with the smell of its own farts, which, like, sometimes that's annoying, not this time. This song came up on hashtag Old Lady Walk Shuffle the other day. I am never mad when it comes up, because it just is like, it is a way of letting you be in a video about the movie that is your own life while you're going to the post office. Everyone needs that on a weekday. I got it, thanks to Duane Eddy. I just think this song is like, it's both sui generis and like mercilessly efficient at making you feel like a star for listening to it, which I think is a big, I think that's a big part of what some pop songs mean to me, is like, what's the video here? And this is, I mean, this is just like, there's not a story. It's just strutting. And there's like, I mean, the pelvis is involved. I don't know. I just think it's really good. And I'm glad that more people got to hear it thanks to this soundtrack. So yeah, number 2. This is a skinny limb and I'm way out on it. So let me have it.
I love the way that you say it makes you feel like a star when you're listening to it. That is such a good distillation of songs like this. It's also honestly how I feel about Land of a Thousand Dances. I mean, there are some songs that you put on and you're just like, Yeah. Another one of those actually is Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves.
Yes.
You know,
absolutely.
You put that song on, you're walking down the street, you're like, yeah, I actually am having a boss ass time right now.
Mm-hmm.
I also do want to note that Duane Eddy lived until April of 2024. He died on April 30th of this year at the age of 86. So he made it a nice long time.
And good job.
Even though this is a different movie from 1994 that we've talked about, Rebel Rouser would have been right at home on the Pulp Fiction soundtrack, if you ask me.
Yes, absolutely.
I love this song. I put it in ninth place only because things have to go places. But there are a lot of songs on this album that I like, and this is one of them, and I am happy to hear it at any time. Now, the patrons unfortunately put it in last. And
they didn't listen to it, did they?
I think that that has to be what it is, because if you listen to this song, there's no way you put it in last place, I think. But yeah. I think that, you know, there are so many. I asked the patrons to vote for their top 8 songs out of these 16. And so people are going to, obviously, they're like, well, I actually already have a lot of relationship with California Dreamin', et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
But I will say, patrons or listeners at all, if you have not listened to Rebel Rouser ever or recently, do yourself a treat and put it on while you're cleaning the house, and then suddenly you're going to feel like the baddest ass ever to scrub out a bathtub.
I mean, you really can. There's no lyrics. It's an instrumental, but you really can almost hear them like leaning back from their mics in the studio and like nodding at each other like, right? We can really play. This song is the tits. Like, which I love that. Like, it's nice when rock knows that it rocks,
you know, and it,
you know, like be happy. You're good at this.
There's a way there's a way of being cocky that is still endearing. Mm-hmm. And a song like this is both cocky and endearing. And that is a tough trick to pull off. But when you can do it, it's really great. You know, I would say that like also, there are certain Freddie Mercury vocal riffs that you can tell he's just like, can you do this? No.
Yep.
But it doesn't matter. I'm like, yeah, be cocky, baby, because you can do it. And or like on Mariah Carey's song Emotions, you can tell she's like, yeah, I'm doing this because I fucking can. And I like that. So this song is a great example of cocky but charming. And Duane Eddy, man. Okay, now next we have Scott McKenzie's San Francisco, and then the, in its own way, awesome parenthetical title, Be Sure to Wear Flowers in Your Hair.
Yep.
This is a song that, like California Dreamin', is written by John Phillips. And I'm going to say in advance, John Phillips and Scott McKenzie co-wrote Kokomo, and that's just something we have to live with.
Yeah, I have a clip of this, which I pulled with the knowledge that Mark despises this song. But I'm not going to give it a kidney or anything, but let's hear a clip and then we can talk about why I don't hate it and why I think Mark at the same time is correct too. I don't have the like music math theory language to talk about what is happening in those opening bars where you have the guitar chords and then the chimes that are sort of doing something else, like thesis, antithesis, synthesis into the first vocal.
Right.
I don't know how to explain what is happening there, but I think it's both disorienting a little bit and also like harmonic and pretty. And that paralleling the Summer of Love content, I also think that this vocal is like thinks that it is selling the concept of like, you know, go to the Bay Area and, you know, you'll get fed and eat acid and listen to music and the Sunset Park and all that stuff. And actually it was like, you know, more like a Joan Didion essay. Here we are again, Joan Didion. Hey, girl. But I just think that there's more going on here than the song realizes.
Mm.
But that opening sort of like zigzag resolution into the verse is just fascinating to me in how it works. And I do think that it does. This is also treacly, and I'm not going to defend it, but I did have it an eighth, 9 points.
So when I was,
they got to stop playing it over scenes of the Golden Gate Bridge, though, and that's a fact. Sorry, go ahead.
So when I was a kid, of course, my mom would play the radio because she was driving the car, and she often played the oldie station, and most of the time, I was either fine with or neutral about anything that came on the radio. But for whatever reason, when I was a kid, I hated this song. And it was the only time I could remember protesting what was playing on the radio. And so I had internalized that I hated this song and had not listened to it in so long. But Sarah, I was shocked to discover as I listened to it now that I don't hate it, actually.
Oh.
I was like, okay. Okay, this song is actually kind of pretty. And there is a sort of mournful quality to the singing. And I agree with you that I'm not sure the song is intended to have the sadness in it or the Joan Didion cold awareness of the rot underneath the beauty.
Yeah.
But it does have that, and I'm not sorry to hear it. And so I actually ended up putting it in 10th place and gave it 7 points. For a song that I assumed based on my admittedly 37-year-old history, like, you know, I was going off the opinions of a 6-year-old when I was thinking about it. I assumed it would be really close to the bottom, and instead it made it all the way up to 10, and the patrons put it in 11th place with 6 points. So
I think that's about right.
Yeah, so there you go. Now, we also have a clip of our next song, and I believe you pulled it, if I'm not mistaken.
I did. Welcome to the kind of anti-sea chanty Sloop John B by the Beach Boys, which is like also kind of not a typical, like you're used to, like cars, girls, surfing, and then there's this fucking, I mean, was their ship taken over by pirates? I'm still not totally clear on what happened on the Sloop John B. It wasn't good. The song is, though. Here's a clip.
And then he took and he ate up all of my corn. Let me go home. Why don't they let me go home? This is the worst trip I've ever been on. Hoist up the John B. Hoist up.
I mean, it's kind of a classic sound from the Beach Boys, but then there's this really dark, like, you know, the Wager by David Grann, as sung by the Beach Boys. Ooh. Like, what is happening? This is the worst trip I've ever been on, and the fact that they switch to another guy on the vocal, I forget who that is, one of the Loves, maybe?
Probably.
Or Al, the little one?
Oh, Al Jardine, yeah.
Yes. This is the worst trip I've ever been, like, word. I have sung that so many times on various, like, vacations, commutes, like, even standing in line to, like, get let into a concert. It's like, this is the worst. It's so handy. This is also on the hashtag Old Lady Walk playlist. I never skip it. This is my number one song with 16 points.
Yes.
I regret nothing.
Yes. Well,
maybe
listen.
This is the worst trip you've ever been on, but I fucking love it. Fly the Jolly Roger. This song fucking rules.
You're so right about the ubiquity of, or the perpetual usefulness of the line, this is the worst trip I've ever, because you can use it when you're just at a long line at the drive-through.
Yes.
You can use it. Like, for example, in fact, this is not a joke. Yesterday, I sang this to myself because I was trying to get all the ingredients for a panna cotta that my husband was making, and I could not find heavy cream. I had to go to 3 grocery stores to find heavy whipping cream. And by the third one, I was singing to myself, this is the worst trip I've ever been on. Because I was like, yeah. Come on, Publix. Are you going to finally? Thank God we found it at the Publix. But good Lord.
The Publix.
Clever. You're the first person to ever make that joke.
Yes.
I also should let you know that in the days of AOL, my father's name is Gary Blankenship, and his AOL screen name was Sloop Gary B.
Oh, my God.
Which is amazing. No, I don't think you did.
I mean, just a string of cartoon hearts streaming out of my eyes right now. I have sung it about Dan, my husband, the Sloop Dan B.
Yep.
If we're just sitting in, it's like the traffic before the bridge going to Cape Cod. It's like, oh, God. So hoist up the Dan B sail.
I feel like that in the cultural memory, the Beach Boys have been reduced to peppy songs about surfing. And a song like Sloop John B was a number 3 hit in the United States. They took a traditional pirate song and made it into a top 3 hit. The Beach Boys had a lot going on. And if you listen to the song Good Vibrations, that song structurally is really wild. Like, it's, what the hell is this? In a good way. So I love this song too. And I put this song in 8th place, but that's not an insult to the song. I think this song is great. I think the Beach Boys are great. And the patrons put it in 4th place. So a lot of love, a lot of love for Sloop John B. And a lot of deserved love, I would say.
I think so.
Now, I am so excited to be able to talk about this next song, and I will admit up front, I am the one who forced Stoned Love by the Supremes into this episode.
Oh, but no, I backed that play for sure.
Hot damn. Because, first of all, this is the first top 10 hit, or in fact, the first single released by the Supremes after Diana Ross left the group. And you want to talk about groups where you need a degree in calculus to track who's in the group and who isn't. The Supremes are definitely up there. So by the time that this song was released, Gene Terrell was the lead singer, but Mary Wilson was still in the group, and Cindy Birdsong was in the group at this point. And I should back up. It was actually the second hit that this new lineup of the Supremes had. They first reached the top 10 with Up the Ladder to the Roof, which is also a fantastic song.
Love that song.
Then they released a song called Everybody's Got the Right to Love, which stalled at 21. Who knows? And then Stoned Love was the final top 10 hit for the Supremes, the second and last hit with the Gene Terrell era, number 7 on the Hot 100. And I think it's just a fantastic example of what the Supremes sound was. And frankly, it demonstrates that they could make good Supreme sounding songs without Diana Ross, which is not to in any way diminish Diana Ross's achievements. And of course, her solo career was great too. But I think this is a fantastic song, and I think it gets unfairly forgotten because it is not from the Diana Ross era. If it had been Diana on the lead vocal, I think it would have probably gone to number 1. Here's a clip from Stoned Love.
I disagree that this didn't need Diana Ross. I also disagree that it's great. I had it in 13th place with 4 points. There's something about, something doesn't match up here for me. Like, the arrangement does not match up with what I know the content is about. Mm. And I feel like that could be cool and could be like an evocative inversion, but it doesn't work for me. And I feel like Diana Ross could have bridged that gap more effectively. I just feel like her vocal would have been a little more plugged into the divergence between arrangement and content. It's just my opinion. What I don't know is a lot, but I do know that this song is really not memorable to me. And I think you're right that it would have gone to number one with Diana Ross, because Diana Ross would have been a better storyteller for it.
Ooh.
In my opinion, I doubt anyone else agrees with me, but it's only 4 points for me. Sorry, ladies.
I think that you... Okay. Am I maybe
are wrong? Over, you can just say that.
No, I think I actually maybe am over-indexing on Stoned Love because it's such a song that is forgotten and I'm trying. I like want to fight for the underdog. Mm. I did only put it in 11th place. I mean, let's be clear.
Okay.
And
okay.
It is, there are 11 songs in this episode that I like, and it is the last of the songs that I like. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel like, I guess one of the things and frankly, I'll be honest, one of the things that's making me like it so much is that it is a completely lost song. Mm, and I think it's fun to dig out a Supremes hit and be like, look, the patrons, by the way, put it in 15th place. So with only 2 points.
Shit.
Yeah.
Now, scandalo.
One thing I do think is interesting to note about this song, it's called Stoned Love, even though they are clearly singing stone love in the song.
Yeah.
And that was a typographical error that was just never corrected. Because the kid who wrote it, he was an actual kid. He was a teenager who won a songwriting contest. His name was Kenny Thomas. And
he won
a contest to write this song. And then a guy named Frank Wilson helped finish it. But he was trying to say stone love, as in love that will last forever.
Right.
Stone classic, that kind of thing. But it became Stoned Love and created some sort of mini controversy because people thought they were singing about getting high and fucking. But they weren't.
Yeah.
Anyway, between 11th, 15th, and 13th, this is not going to be on the podium at the end of this episode.
No. I don't think so.
Now, years ago, Sarah, we did an episode of Lost Dolly Parton Songs or Underrated Dolly Parton Songs. You put I'm Gone on there. It was such a great Dolly Parton song. And I put her cover of Turn, Turn, Turn into the episode because I just think that the vocal on that is great. And it was a nice reminder that Turn, Turn, Turn by The Byrds is also a very good song. And The Byrds, yet another group where you're like, who is in this group? Let me get my slide rule to figure that out.
Yeah, who isn't in this group? Yeah,
yeah, totally. Exactly. Like, and honestly, I don't even know. I don't have the energy to figure out who was in The Byrds when Turn, Turn, Turn was a hit because life is too short. But it was a huge hit at the time. It reached number one. How do you feel? How do you feel about the song?
My, like, the fact that it was based on Bible verses, when I figured that out in, I don't know how old I was, like 13. Just like blew my mind. I thought that was so deep. And such a comment on, I don't know, like Christian teachings and anti-war, blah, blah, blah. Like whatever you think is deep about pop music when you're 13, which is actually just, you know, a bunch of people not that much older than you getting roll baked and leafing through Proverbs. Anyway, this is iconic. It is a little dated in its like uber sincere 60s, like let's put a flower in a gun barrel, blah, blah, blah. But the sound is such, like if you had to pick one like chord progression to sort of stand in for the entire piece movement, aside from war, what is it good for? This is probably it. It's just like such a clarion call back to that time. And it's pleasing to listen to. It has this timeless feel, but also is like a little bit dated at the same time. I don't know why that's true. But yeah, I think that this one actually maybe kind of coming back around a little bit in terms of like people were overusing it for a long time, which peaked with Forrest Gump. And then people just started using the Buffalo Springfield instead to its detriment. I had this in 10th and it doesn't mean that I don't like it. I just, someone had to be 10th. So 7 points from me for The Byrds.
I can hear that guitar, that opening guitar. Mm-hmm. And then
it's so good.
I mean, and I just find it very pleasing. And for whatever reason, mm-hmm. you mentioned this earlier, this is a song that I think survives overplay. I just find mm-hmm. it, and it's not, like you said, it's not so different from For What It's Worth. And yet for me, this is the one that I like. I just find it very pleasant, and it doesn't hurt that Dolly Parton did a good version. So I put it in fifth place with 12 points, and the patrons put it in third with 14.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it this episode that I predicted that there was just going to be a lot of like 20s?
Yeah.
And then one winner.
You were correct. We have really been all over the place, and I'm going to need some extra time in the magic of editing to do the rankings, but I'll be back in just a second with the final placements.
All right.
In the cool of the evening when everything is getting kind of groovy, I call you up and ask you if you'd like to go with me and see a movie. First you say no, you got some plans for the night, and then you stop and say, all right, love is kind of crazy with a spooky little girl like you.
Okay. So we're not going to go through all 16 rankings because this episode is already pretty hefty in its length. But let me just first tell you, Sarah, our negative podium. In very last place with a mere 7 points, it's Bob Dylan with Rainy Day Women numbers 12 and 35. Yes, yes, it's only 7 points for Bobbo. Just above him in 15th place, negative silver, BJ Thomas, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, 11 points only.
Enough of them.
Exactly. And in negative bronze, it's the Supremes with 12 points for Stoned Love.
Okay.
Now, however, let's jump all the way back up to the actual podium. Our bronze medalist today, and I do want to say it's incredibly close here at the top. There's like 1 point separating seventh all the way through first, basically. In third place with 37 points is Fortunate Son.
Okay.
In second place with 38 points, so every vote counted, is Sloop John B.
Yes!
Yes!
This is the best trip that's ever been on.
And then in first place by a hefty 5-point margin is California Dreamin'.
Huh. That is absolutely not how I thought any of that was going to go, but that's why we play the games, and we could not do this without you guys. Thank you so much for voting. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Bleav Network, where we are hosted. That's BLEAV.com if you want to hear more of their podcasts. And Patreon.com/MassDes to get in on the democratic process as we have defined it for ourselves.
And join us next time as we wrap up this season on Ranking 90s Soundtracks when we take on Baz Luhrmann's version of Romeo and Juliet. I'm gonna give you a preview and say it's gonna be intense.
Yeah, that's one word for it.
Yep. More to come as we tackle Romeo and Juliet and perhaps feel tackled by Romeo and Juliet. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you next time.
Shoot Mark and Sarah talk about Shoot Mark. Marsh and Sarah talk about songs.
Thank you for listening to Bleav. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Bleav.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.